The midlife boomer obsession with values is propelling a huge growth of evangelical and New Age believers. Two boomers in three say they've been touched by a supernatural power. Among their elders, less than half do. America's middle-aged believers are fleeing mainline churches for fast-growing fundamentalist, charismatic, and breakaway redeemer sects that dress casually or ethnically, sing lively songs, listen to guitar and brimstone homilies, erupt in periodic applause, and engage in other rites drawn from the recovery movement. Boomers are adding new chic to old S-words like sacred, spiritual, soul, sin, shame, and Satan. Books on heaven, hell, out-of-body, and near-death experiences have become bestsellers. Angel Books sold 5 million copies in 1993 alone. The Unraveling's boomer-led family is predicated on a rebirth and blending of gender roles. Midlife women recall their GI mothers as not assertive enough. Midlife men recall their fathers as not reflective enough. Both are taking steps to correct this in themselves and others. Crafting a post-awakening masculinity as suitable for churches as for homes, boomer males are rejecting GI man's manliness and silent angst for a new gender definition Newsweek calls the godly man. They are massing in wilderness retreats, the Million Man March, and evangelical promise keepers rallies where men hold hands in a football stadium. The list of men's books has turned into a flood, from the Dave Barry's Guy Culture to mythopoetic literature to tales of gender spirituality. On race, boomers are rerooting a traditional ethnic consciousness and asserting an intense new spirituality. Across ideologies, boomer blacks agree that awakening-era laws and programs helped them as individuals, but also engendered a culture of poverty that damaged their communities. They are more likely than their white peers to be born again and favor school prayer, and often voice regret that the core of African-American leadership has passed from churches to government. As they back away from traditional civil rights organizations, boomer blacks are less likely than the silent to stress pluralism or solicit money from white taxpayers or private donors. Instead, says one Muslim, they are intent on replacing the integrated head on the civil rights movement's black body with a black head. Much of the new race talk is away from procedural rights and equal opportunity and towards strengthening families, stopping crime, and saving children. If rectifying civic virtue requires harsh new restrictions on child freedoms, boomers everywhere, from inner cities to walled suburbs, are fully prepared for them. To date, the child's world is the one place where this middle-aged generation has fully focused. Yet the severe, intrusive, perfectionist approach boomers have applied here is a sure sign of what will gradually happen elsewhere as the unraveling continues. As boomers move more deeply into midlife, their collective mindset will grow more judgmental, snobbish, and severe. By nurture and habit, they will remain disinclined to do the regular or polite things that facilitate community life. Yet by midlife conviction, they will become what E.J. Dionne describes as civic liberals and civic conservatives, obsessed with restoring American citizenship. This will pose a conundrum for boomer parents and leaders as they traverse the millennium. How can a generation that can't march in a row tell others to do so? Graying boomers will respond by tying their awakening-era credos about personal growth and authenticity ever more tightly to new imperatives of social altruism. Many will redefine their jobs to stress the inspirational or preaching role. America will see more of what Newt Gingrich calls didactic politicians, public crafters of what Bennett calls the architecture of the soul. Come the OOs, boomers will begin to find new uses for government. Where the first half of the unraveling saw the rerooting of boomer Republicans, the second half will see the rerooting of boomer anti-Republicans. Like Mickey Kouse in End of Equality, boomer liberals will propose replacing the remnants of the Great Society with something less materially promising but more morally exacting. Yet no matter who gains high office, liberals or conservatives, many backers of the winning faction will wonder if high office in an era of ideological rage and train-wrecked government is where they really want to be, and if a tactical loss might not prove to be a strategic victory. For boomer partisans who are out of power, the late unraveling will mainly be an occasion to retool and jockey for long-range advantage. On the culture wars front, boomer communitarians, liberal and conservative, will gradually prevail over the libertarians. They will zero in on what Martha Bayles calls the hole in our soul, the loss of beauty and meaning in America's unraveling culturama. What John Leo calls hair-trigger Puritans will attack licentiousness in the belief that the whole community is threatened by misdirected private pleasures. Boomer virtucrats of all ideologies will increasingly distrust any path that doesn't hurt. The prescription will not be a sugar-coated cure, but a purgative tonic. From chain gangs to diet loaf prison food to courtrooms where victims confront criminals, boomers will re-stigmatize crime and emphasize expressive justice that judges the sinner along with the sin. Boomer rhetoric will offer many polarizing arguments, but few big institutional changes. National politics will become an arena for fierce arguments about new proposals that even the strongest partisans will know can't yet be enacted or enforced. Boomer congresses will find ways to separate arguments about the federal budget from the budget itself, which will grind away without fundamental change. Not able to decide who is worse, the rich or the poor, boomers will censure them both and impose symbolic but minor punishments. Some supposedly excessive income will be taxed from the one side, some undeserved welfare slashed from the other. The result will be a vast and rusted-out public sector stripped of an engine, but with nothing ready to replace it. Influencing these policy debates will be new stock figures, the roving philosopher professionals, their careers held together only by the twisting thread of their own personality. The cutting-edge idea prescriptors will be author politicians like Al Gore, Bill Bennett, or Bill Bradley, people who fuse spirituality with grassroots activism. Many boomers who preach honesty and sacrifice will remain personally self-indulgent, like Bill Gates, whose eco-friendly mansion has a garage for 20 cars. The cultural elite will consume heavily while pretending otherwise. Where GIs once liked to surround themselves with regular and rational and progressive things, boomers will prefer the unique and sacred and traditional, and they will redefine what progress means. Already they are attacking such old GI yardsticks as the gross domestic product on the grounds that they overmeasure the mere payment of money, since divorce lawyers and industrial pollution technically add to the GDP, and undermeasure what truly matters, since saving a species or teaching values to children count as zero. Materially, most boomers freely concede that they're not living much better in middle age than their parents did. At age 40, where a typical GI worker during the high enjoyed a 2/3 rise in real pay over the previous generation at the same age, a typical boomer worker has shown no real improvement. Yet their self-esteem remains indomitable. By a 5-to-1 ratio, 1990s-era boomers consider their careers better than their parents, and by 9-to-1, their lives more meaningful. By the 00s, those views will harden. Downwardly mobile boomers will face the truth about the way they live now with some dignity and grace, writes Katie Butler. If it's by choice and it's not overwhelming, having no money can be a way of entering more deeply into your life. Boomer recusants who choose not to achieve, by any worldly standard, will have second thoughts about information age technology. For many, the 00s will be time to shed the tech toys, abandon workaholism, and downshift. In family and financial affairs, the late unraveling will be a sobering time. Boomers will have to say farewell to most of their remaining GI parents, often after a geographic separation dating back to the awakening era and fumbled efforts at reconciliation that betray mixed motives on both sides, as in Bud Light's "I Love You, Man" commercial. Parental death will confront boomers with an embarrassing reality for people their age, that the providers they had somehow counted on are gone, and that what's left, in inheritance, is somehow not as much as they had imagined. Thrift will become a big, late, unraveling buzzword among boomers, as they make a big deal out of all the income they are diverting into mutual funds. But as always, this generation will have trouble following through. Some will resist the notion of disciplining themselves for the sake of lucre. Others, looking at the run-up in stock and bond prices caused by their sheer midlife numbers, will assume the market boom will last forever and cut back on savings accordingly. Politically, boomers will continue to support Social Security and Medicare for their own parents while also believing that both will be bankrupt by the time they retire. Into the OOs, their leaders will talk constantly but do very little about this looming threat to the material security of their own age, a threat that will now loom closer. Gradually, the old wry detachment will give way to a jarring new focus. Boomers will at long last be ready to accept full responsibility for their own old age and for hard choices facing their nation. Next, let's look at 13ers as they enter young adulthood. America's college class of 1983 came with a new label, the first public welcome of their coming-of-age generation. Around the time of their graduation, the U.S. Office of Education published a major report, A Nation at Risk, describing the nation's student population as a rising tide of mediocrity, whose learning will not surpass, will not equal, will not even approach that of their parents. This diatribe became the first in a flurry of reports, studies, and books, keynoted by Alan Bloom's The Closing of the American Mind, that castigated America's new youth as mindless, soulless, and dumb. Through the early unraveling years, recent graduates heard older writers and columnists call them a nowhere generation, a tired generation, a generation of animals, a high-expectation, low-sweat generation, and an army of Bart Simpsons, armed and possibly dangerous. In the early 1990s, as Wayne and Garth chanted, "We're not worthy," from a dingy basement, America's 20-somethings begrudgingly settled on the label Generation X. Today's youths often regard their own circles of friends as too diverse to be thought of in collective terms. Compared to every other generation born this century, theirs is less cohesive, its experiences wider, its ethnicity more polyglot, and its culture more splintery. Yet all this is central to their collective persona. From music to politics, to academics to income, today's young adults define themselves by sheer divergence, a generation less knowable for its core than by its bits and pieces. As the 1990s have progressed, young adults have asserted more control over their own image. The generational TV shows have taken X from the glitzy Beverly Hills 90210 to the atomized Melrose Place to the ersatz community of Friends, whose cast resembles the people who watched those other X shows. Many of the storylines depict youths as noncommittal, unattached, brazen about sex and work, obsessed with little things, and isolated from the worlds of older people or children. X got hypermarketed, declared Copeland in 1995, and now I'm here to say that X is over. From Copeland to Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder, putative leaders of the youth culture declared no interest in speaking for anybody. The whole X persona has come to be perceived as such a mess that nobody wants to identify with it, as if to cut all connection with a loser. Often, talk of X has degenerated into pretentious put-downs by a boomer-dominated media bent on confirming the superior authenticity of their own awakening-era youth. To hear many 13ers tell it, following boomers into youth is like entering a theme park after a mob has trashed the place and a distant CEO has turned every idea into a commercial logo. "Make love, not war," sounds so absurd to me, sings Extreme, confirming America's latest generation gap. To get a fix on today's young adult generation, forget the X. Look beyond the pop media deluge and skip the boomers. Focus instead on their place in history, number 13, and how different 13ers are at this age from the generation that nurtured them, the silent. Where the silent were children of crisis who came of age in a high, 13ers were children of awakening who came of age in an unraveling. Where the silent grew up just when a hungry society wanted to invest, 13ers grew up just when a satiated society wanted to cash out. Where the silent came of age in an era when individualism was discouraged but economic success guaranteed, 13ers are coming of age when individualism is celebrated but economic success is up for grabs. With the silent, prosperity and institutional stability gradually exceeded expectations, allowing them to turn their focus to effect and detail, With 13ers, the opposite happened, and expectations were betrayed. Where the silent came of age with how to succeed in business without really trying, 13ers have the stark declinism of rent, riveting them on the bottom lines of life. Generational economics bear this out. Unraveling era 13ers, males especially, have been hit with a one-generation depression. From 1973 to 1992, the real median income for young adult males fell by 28%, more than it did for the entire nation from peak to trough of the Great Depression. Notwithstanding this harsh youth economy, the image of 90210-style wealth, cars, TVs, CD players, leather logo jackets, has wrapped itself tightly around 13ers. Yet what sociologist Gerald Bachman calls premature affluence has done more harm than good. It is a custom used to parentally subsidize luxuries they cannot possibly afford on their own, and it has persuaded older generations that if some young people aren't doing well, they only have themselves to blame. Lacking any guarantee that slow but steady follow-the-rules-and-trust-in-the-future behavior will ever pay off, 13ers tend to view the world as run by lottery markets, in which a person either lands the one big win or goes nowhere. From this fatalism, they have constructed a flinty ethos of self-determination, in which being rich or poor has less to do with virtue than with timing, salesmanship, and luck. What people get is simply what they get, and is not necessarily related to what they may or may not deserve. Their dating and mating reflects much the same quest for risk amid decline, for modularity amid chaos, for doing what works amid constant elder judgments about right and wrong. Where the young silent looked at sex as euphoric, marriage as romantic, and feminism as a thrilling breakthrough, 13ers look at sex as dangerous, marriage as what a St. Elmo's Fire character calls all financial, and gender equality as a necessary survival tool in a world of wrecked courtship rituals, splintered families, and unreliable husbands. As older feminists debate what Deanna Rex calls problems of affluence and success rather than serious ones, 13er women are more concerned about immediate self-defense against AIDS, date rape, and street crime, and longer-term self-defense against potential spouses who might be unreliable providers or abandon their families. As the youngest copulating and oldest marrying generation ever recorded, 13ers maneuver through an unusually long span of sexually active singlehood, with the threat of AIDS ever lingering in the background. They have always been the physical center of the abortion debate, first as the surviving fetuses of the most aborted generation in U.S. history, later as the pregnant unmarried women faced with the choice of what to do. Small wonder 13ers have such split feelings about the consciousness revolution. They fantasize about how the 60s and 70s supposedly offered boomers easy sex without consequence, while feeling bitter about the lasting damage done by an era in which they know they were the babies adults were trying so hard not to have. A similar alertness to hard truths, and anxiety about danger, informs the 13er view of race. They are coming of age in an unraveling era that declares it acceptable for institutions, but not individuals, to discriminate on the basis of race. Exactly the opposite of what the silent encountered in the high. The 13er's real diversity problem is less racial or ethnic than economic and familial. Young black professionals are faring nearly as well as white peers, while uneducated 13er blacks are doing worse than one or two generations before. Political surveys show 13ers to be somewhat more conservative, considerably less liberal, and far more independent than older generations are today or were at like age. Never knowing anything except institutional decline, 13ers are deeply skeptical about grand policy visions they assume will somehow only add to America's fiscal debt and social chaos. For many, non-voting is an acceptable social choice. More than 3 13ers in 4 do not trust government to look after their basic interests. As they see it, other people get benefits while they pay the bills. Nearly every major unraveling era policy proposal on taxes, health care, or social security has proposed transferring more money from youth to elders. And 13ers are even less inclined than boomers to believe that paying now will benefit them later when they grow old in their own turn. A third millennium survey found that more 13ers believe in UFOs than in Social Security lasting until they retire. Thus has arisen the downward spiral of 13er civic behavior. They tune out, so they don't vote, so their interests are trampled, so they tune out, and on it goes. Many 13ers prefer to express their community spirit not by voting, but by hands-on volunteering. They believe that society is changed not by presidential orders or million-man marches, but by the day-to-day acts of ordinary people. More than older generations, 13ers believe in doing small acts of kindness as individuals, without caring if anybody applauds or even notices. The president of MIT has likened their civic attitude to that of the Lone Ranger. Do a good deed, leave a silver bullet, and move on. By the early 00s, economics will continue to tell the 13er story. Young adult incomes will be lower, their poverty rate higher, and their safety nets skimpier than was true for boomers in the early 80s, confirming the 13th as the only U.S. generation, aside perhaps from the gilded, ever to suffer a lifetime economic slide. Many will buffer their downward mobility by working multiple jobs, living in multiple income households or with parents, and streamlining their consumption habits. An unraveling that began unfriendly to entry-level job seekers will close unfriendly to promotion seekers. From professional partnerships to store manager positions, 13ers will find their paths blocked by institutions that aren't expanding and by older generations who aren't leaving. This is already the first generation born in this century to be less certifiably professional than its predecessors. Many 13ers will resign themselves to being permanent temps, no-benefit contractors, second-tier careerists, and lesser-paid replacements. Into the 00s, whatever 30 to 40-ish people do will be criticized by elders, not just for failing to meet the prior standard, but also for being a bad influence on kids. This generation will personify what America will dislike about the widening gap between haves and have-nots. Its failures will be perceived as deserved, its successes as less so. High-flying youths will be condemned as economic predators and appropriate targets of luxury taxation, while low-lifers will be assailed as incorrigible and unworthy of public aid. By the end of the unraveling, the American social category with the greatest reputation for virtue will be the one to which relatively few young adults will belong, the middle class. The 13er high-risk mindset will come under attack as a national affliction. High-stakes entrepreneurs will be busy arbitraging deals and acquiring U.S. assets for foreign interests. They will be making markets more fluid, leveraging more risk, establishing more distance and anonymity in the links between debtors and their creditors, and flooding the world with American pop culture. In cyberspace, they will be hacking, spamming, code-breaking, and tax-evading. For all this, they will come under heavy criticism, prompting urgent new calls for government regulation. At the same time, 13ers will be the fungible workers of the unraveling's globalized economy. Where young silent generation workers let others negotiate for them, 13ers will strike their own deals, stressing near-term incentives like piecework or commissions. Where the typical silent expected to stay with a first employer for decades, the typical 13er will expect a rapid turnover of employers and work situations. Economists have long said that this sort of worker is what an ever-changing global economy needs. But once America acquires a whole generation of them, older managers won't be so pleased. The perceived problem won't be whether 13ers work enough, which they will, but rather their distance from corporate culture. Young workers will follow the contract. When it's time to work, they will be totally focused. But when it's quitting time, they will disengage. Many 13ers will skip the institutional world entirely and go it alone or with friends, outpacing and underpricing older rivals, playing crafty high-tech games with and against elder-built systems. A distinctly 13er brand of what Seren Sakurai calls counter-commerce will steal markets from big corporations, undermine rule-encrusted state enterprises, and mount gray-market challenges to credentialed professions. By the 00s, 40-ish novelists, filmmakers, and pop stars will be pushing every niche, every extravagance, every extreme sport, every technology, every shock, sex, violence, profanity, apathy, self-mutilation to the maximum, prompting boomer calls for boycotts and censorship. As young adult attendance sags at national parks, historic sites, museums, and classical concerts, a clear demarcation will exist between the 13er fun culture and the boomer classic alternative. sports and celebrity entertainments will acquire a brassy quality, more akin to gladiatorial than civic ritual. Athletes and entertainers will raise sports and media to new heights of commercial superstardom. Star salaries will skyrocket even higher, but journeymen will lose ground. Their individual exploits will be applauded, their team spirit condemned. Fan loyalties will weaken as parents urge children to look elsewhere for role models. Eventually, the 13er youth culture will come to feel, like Kurt Cobain before his suicide, bored and old. Near the end of the unraveling, 13ers will start tiring of all the motion and options. They will want to reverse their life direction. Those who are doing well will reveal a young fogey siege mentality that discourages further risk-taking. High-achieving married 13ers will continue to push family life toward a pragmatic form of social conservatism. Restoring the single-earner home will be a male priority. Restoring the reliability of marriage will be a feminist priority. In time, even 13ers without good jobs will take comfort in their toeholds on the American dream. On the whole, they will come to appreciate the worth and precariousness of whatever good fortune they have achieved, and will fear how far they could fall if they ever lost it. They will scrupulously avoid risk in their personal lives, even if they still have no choice but to keep taking long shots in their work lives. They will become intensely frugal, loyal to kin, faithful to spouses, and protective of children. They won't take a close and supportive family for granted. Building one will be an achievement in which they will take great pride. By the 00s, 13ers will comfortably inhabit a world of unprecedented diversity. Asian and Hispanic Americans will make 13er race issues a more multivariant equation. As those ethnicities catapult into the cultural mainstream, they will be greeted with demands for a clampdown on immigration. From poverty to crime to simply making families work again, 13ers will redefine old civil rights issues into problems independent of race. Many will come to associate the phrase civil rights with elder ministers, teachers, and bureaucrats whom they won't want meddling in their lives. Their goal will be to stop all the racial game playing. As more 13ers form families, they will finally start voting in respectable numbers. By 1998, they will comprise America's largest potential generational voting bloc, and by the end of the unraveling, the largest actual bloc. They will apply their pop and politics skills on the internet for the benefit of candidates who avoid hype and who do what it takes to get a job done, and who promise not to make their problems worse. The first prominent 13er politicians will detach positions from principles, simplify the complex, and strip issue debates to their fundamentals. To their mindset, no program will be untouchable, no promise inviolable, no budget incapable of balance. They will propose bold new remedies to crack down on the unraveling era's most elusive targets, from trial lawyers to wealthy pensioners to corporations at the public trough. Among their first political goals will be to eliminate no-fault divorce and racial quotas. Their no-nonsense pragmatism will be criticized by the silent as uninformed, by boomers as unprincipled. Few of their proposals will be enacted. Not yet, anyway. As the unraveling nears an end, the public image of a worn-out era will fuse with the image of a worn-out and unraveled generation. By the mid-00s, the 13er persona will be thrown into relief not just by very different older generations, but also now by a very different younger generation. As always, 13ers will handle it with a shrug before going ahead and doing what they must, knowing that, as a generation, they are not getting anything except older. Finally, let's turn our attention to the millennials, the generation currently in childhood and being born. Around Christmas time of 1983, adult America fell in love with a precious new doll, harvested from nature, so wrinkly and cuddly that everybody thought it cute. By the hundreds of thousands, Cabbage Patch Kids decorated the playpens of a new millennial generation of babies. Through the unraveling, as these Cabbage Patch babies have grown into Power Ranger preteens, a protective wave of adult concern has surged along with them. As they entered preschool, adults experienced what Harvard's Arthur Miller termed a national hysteria about child abuse, and polls reported a 3-year tripling in the popularity of staying home with family. When the first millennials reached elementary school, children's issues topped the agenda in the 1988 and 1992 presidential election races, and the United Way launched a huge new children's agenda. As they reached junior high, proposals were made for a new V-chip that would enable parents to screen out violent programming. 3/4 of the nation's 200 largest cities enacted youth curfews, and state legislatures pursued deadbeat dads and changed custody rules for the welfare of children, not, as in the awakening era, for the convenience of parents. With the first millennials on the verge of high school, the 1990s became what Mario Cuomo termed the decade of the child. From crime to welfare, from technology to gun control, healthcare to balanced budgets, nearly every policy issue has been recast as a child issue. Both parties are crafting their messages around the need to save children, whether from deficits or from spending cuts. Millennials are emerging as something of a generational public property. Where child 13ers had once been the cast-offs of awakening-era euphoria, millennials have become symbols of an unraveling-era need to stop the social hemorrhaging before it could damage another new generation. Through the unraveling, a solid adult consensus has emerged that millennial children warrant more protection than 13ers received. Where the cutting-edge fertility issues of the awakening pertain to taking pills or undergoing surgery to avoid unwanted children, the unraveling is marked by advances in fertility medicine, preemie care, and other technologies to produce desperately wanted children. Where the circa 1970s natural childbirth fad focused on the richness of the experience for parents, the circa 1990s priority became longer hospital stays for the sake of the baby. An expanded child safety industry that focused on ICU car mirrors in the 80s started emphasizing child athlete injury prevention in the 90s. The unraveling began with new laws requiring infant restraints in automobiles. Now, new laws mandate bicycle helmets. As boomers have come to lead the institutions that dominate a child's life, they have combined two ascendant words, family values, to capture the gist of millennial nurture. What David Blankenhorn calls the new familism has begun to reverse the awakening's rise in divorce and abortion rates. The stay-at-home parent is a popular choice among families able to afford it. In sharp contrast to in the awakening, a majority of working women now say they would consider giving up work indefinitely if they no longer needed the money. Spurred by the new fatherhood movement, record numbers of American men are stay-at-home nurturers, and when they divorce, they now often demand joint or sole custody. From the Million Man March to its Promise Keepers white equivalent, men are seeking atonement for past child neglect and vowing to become better role models for this generation's future. 2 of every 3 parents say they would accept a pay cut in return for more family time. Thanks to such new workplace trends as job sharing, telecommuting, and career sequencing, parents are putting away the latchkeys and reconstructing an adult presence after school. Unlike circa 1980 13ers, the high-tech child of the 1990s is less a home-alone game freak than a pen pal on the internet with a parent peering over the shoulder. Adult nagging has returned to the child's world. In the high, parents generally loosened the rules from one child to the next. Now the reverse is true, with parents tightening the rules from one child to the next. Boomers on all sides of the culture wars agree that millennial children must be shielded better than 13ers were from media sex, violence, and profanity. When Bill Bennett says that there are, after all, some things that children simply should not see, he delivers a message that his own generation laughed off in the All in the Family awakening years. Responding to Bennett, Tipper Gore, Michael Medved, and others, boomer scriptwriters are crafting plots with stronger moral lessons and less ambivalent messages about drugs, alcohol, and teenage sex. In TV sitcoms, parents are now depicted as more in charge, children as more dutiful. Child TV watching, whose main growth occurred among high-era boomers, is inching down again. Children's books and magazines are returning to simple stories and traditional themes, while new realism books are removed from child shelves to complaints of censorship from their often silent generation authors. The new values nurture is starting to produce a fledgling civic virtue. Since the awakening's end, the child savings rate has nearly tripled. In scouting and elsewhere, more uniformed children are doing good community deeds under adult supervision. Child sports teams have never been more popular. As boomers seek to standardize the culture and values of this child generation, they see advantage in uniform clothing. In 1996, to the nation's applause, President Clinton added his support for school uniforms, a notion that most of his peers would have loathed in their youth. Nearly all school systems are trying to heed Rudolph Giuliani's demand that schools once again train citizens. The new three R's are rules, respect, and responsibility. Some inner-city schools are returning to old-style direct instruction, requiring children to recite their lessons in unison. Calls are mounting for more objective grades, separation of boys and girls, abstinence-only sex education, and school prayer. Like Hillary Clinton, many boomers who once believed in liberating the child from the community are discovering that it takes a village, and now support a strong and protective child community bond. Parents are slowing down the developmental clock, letting millennials linger longer in childhood, reversing what Richard Riley terms the hurry-hustle of the awakening. From Sesame Street to Barney, the most popular TV programming for kids has gone from urban to pastoral, from kinetic to lyrical, from wry to sweet, from discovering the self to sharing with others, from celebrating what makes kids different to celebrating what makes them the same. From their birth, through their arrival in junior high, through the first half of the unraveling, a national spotlight has followed those first Cabbage Patch millennials. Where the first half of the unraveling was marked by rising alarm over the children's problems, the remainder will be marked by rising satisfaction in their achievements. Meanwhile, the cutting edge of initial concern will move on to adolescents, and as the OOs progress, to collegians and young workers. Millennials will provide a focal point for the renewal of the American family. Thanks to a growing presence of telecommuting parents and live-in silent generation grandparents, neighborhoods will retain more daytime adults, whose supervision will grow more assertive. Like Mrs. Clinton, boomers will demand that adolescents' behavior be monitored and constrained through their teens. Like the offspring of well-run kibbutzim, millennials will grow up to be sociable and team-oriented adolescents, but will strike adults as somewhat bland, conformist, and dependent on others to reach judgments. Children will enter their teens looking and behaving better. The new impetus towards upbeat styles and behavior will come from peer pressure, words that, by the OOs, will carry a newly positive connotation. Millennials will police themselves and force a sharp reduction in adolescent miscreants. Teen coupling will become less starkly physical, more romantic and friendly. As teens back away from early and unprotected sex, the adolescent abortion rate will fall. Fewer teens will get pregnant, and adoption or marriage will become more prevalent among those who do. Binge drinking and teen gambling will decline. Just as today's 12-year-olds are confounding experts by turning against the crack cocaine habits of their 13-er predecessors, millennial teens will prove false the consensus prediction among today's criminologists that America is in for a big new youth crime wave. To the contrary, youth crime will decrease. Some youth gangs will gradually redirect their energies from criminal mayhem toward collegial enforcement of an ad hoc public order. Around the year 2000, America's news weeklies will run cover stories singing the praise of American youth for their growing interest in current affairs, rising aptitude scores, good community deeds, and a wholesome and standardized new teen culture. By the end of the unraveling, adult Americans will view 20-year-olds as smart and 40-year-olds as wasted, very different from the perception at the end of the awakening. Impediments against this generation's current and future well-being will not be tolerated. To the extent millennial kids appear to be losers in the free marketplace, adults will demand redress. Youth poverty will fuel a new class politics. Colleges will be pressured into holding the line on tuitions and student indebtedness, faculties into putting teaching ahead of research, employers into creating apprenticeship programs, older workers into making room for the young. Graying boomers will see in millennials a powerful tool for realizing their values and visions deep into the 21st century. Democrats will point to youth as reasons for expanding government, Republicans as reasons for cleaning up the culture. Calls will rise for a spare-no-expense national program of compulsory youth service. The dwindling defenders of public borrowing and of public spending that benefits the old over the young will now hear themselves accused of fiscal abuse, not of hypothetical babies, but of a glorious new generation of junior citizens. old federal budget arguments will feel all the more urgent. Where boomer children came to the conclusion that the adult world was culturally deficient but well-run, millennial children will come to the opposite discovery, that adults understand values well enough but don't know how to apply them to public life. They will reach voting age acutely aware of their own potential power to meet this need. They will organize huge youth rallies and produce vast voter turnouts. A new breed of college activists will band together not to resist national leaders, but to prod them into taking bolder steps. The Arizona Republic recently asked elementary school students how they expect to improve the world. "We should start now," said an 11-year-old boy. "Plant a tree every day. Get groups together." "Can they make a difference?" "I know it. I just feel it," said one cheerful young girl. "I believe in myself because my parents and teachers do." The mood of the early 00s will be much like today's, except a lot more jittery. These will be the years of the reality check, of worries about a looming national payback, as Americans of all ages begin focusing on how poorly they and their government have prepared for the future. People will no longer deny that the unraveling's individual empowerment has led to antisocial behavior and a dangerous degree of institutional decay. The harms, especially to youth, will now be perceived to have accumulated to such a grievous extent that truly fundamental change will be required to get the nation back on course. Today's talk about America's inability to mobilize except for emergencies will have become a tired cliché. More people will start rooting for something big to happen, to shock the society out of its civic ennui. By the middle 00s, institutions will reach a point of maximum weakness, individualism of maximum strength, and even the simplest public task will feel beyond the ability of government. As niche walls rise ever higher, people will complain endlessly about how bad all the other niches are. Wide chasms will separate rich from poor, whites from blacks, immigrants from native-borns, seculars from born-agains, technophiles from technophobes. America will feel more tribal. Indeed, many will be asking whether 50 states and so many dozens of ethnic cultures make sense anymore as a nation, and if they do, whether that nation has a future. People young and old will puzzle over what it felt like for their parents and grandparents, in a distantly remembered era, to have lived in a society that felt like one national community. They will yearn to recreate this, to put America back together again. But no one will know how. As the fourth turning approaches, each generation will view events from its own life cycle perspective. The silent, approaching 80, will be deeply anguished. 60-ish boomers will brood over their institutional powerlessness to impose a cleansing agenda. Broken into shards, 13ers will privately find ways of making small things work in disordered environments. The first millennials will come of age amidst the adulation of elders to whom they will embody the hopes for civic renewal. The problems of childhood now fixed, a new batch of babies will start arriving to hardly a ripple of notice. Each generation will show signs of changing. As each generation reaches the brink of its next phase of life, it will not want to behave like its next elders have. Boomers will be of no mind to carry on an other-directed, self-doubting sentimentalism. The 13ers will have no desire to be argumentative and judgmental. Millennials will earnestly want to shed the cynical alienation of youth. Parents will be disinclined to treat a new generation of children as targets of reform. Toward the end of an unraveling, each archetype's phase of life role reaches a point of new strain. Their unraveling era behavior cannot and will not continue. The public mood will feel stale, used up, primed for something else. Americans will have had quite enough of glitz and roar, of celebrity circuses, of living as though there were no tomorrow. Forebodings will deepen, and spiritual currents will darken. Whether we realize it or not, we will be ready for a dramatic event to shock the nation out of its complacency and decay. The fourth turning will be at hand. Fourth turnings have provided the great pivot points of the Anglo-American legacy. Dating back to the 15th century, there have been six. From the similarities of these eras, we can construct a morphology. A crisis era begins with a catalyst, a startling event or sequence of events that produces a sudden shift in mood. Once catalyzed, a society achieves a regeneracy, a new counter-entropy that reunifies and re-energizes civic life. The regenerated society propels toward a climax, a crucial moment that confirms the death of the old order and triumph of the new. The climax culminates in a resolution, a triumphant or tragic conclusion that resolves the big public questions and establishes the new order. This crisis morphology occurs over the span of one turning, which means that around 15 to 25 years elapse between the catalyst and the resolution. The regeneracy usually occurs 1 to 5 years after the era begins, the climax 1 to 5 years before it ends.